think that raising beef and meat consumption is bad for us as individuals and for our environment? Our guest this hour will challenge that perception. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with a guest who is a vegetarian and a cattle rancher. That's right. Our guest is the author of Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production, the manifesto of an environmental lawyer and vegetarian turned cattle rancher. And she will answer your questions and respond to your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. She says that beef needs to be a part of our food system. She says grass-fed beef or well-raised beef is good for the environment, healthy, and sustainable. Let's welcome our guest, Nicolette Hahn Nyman is an environmental lawyer and cattle rancher in California. She is a longtime vegetarian and author of the 2009 book, Righteous Pork Chop, Finding a Life and Good Food Beyond Factory Farms. And her new book is Defending Beef. It came out last month, and she joins us from California. Good morning, and thanks for getting up extra early.
No problem. It's not. It's about the normal time for me.
Oh, good for you. So, well, you don't know this, but I'm a vegetarian too. And
oh, okay. Well, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I've been a vegetarian for I don't know a quarter of a century or so. I did add fish to it recently, and I occasionally have seafood. So I call myself actually a pescatarian. Tell us. First of all, tell us a little bit of why you're a vegetarian.
Well, it's interesting. It sounds like you and I became vegetarians right around the same time.
Right. Yeah.
So it was about 25 years ago for me. I was in college, and I was a biology major. I was already very active in environmental causes, and I was, you know, studying science and ecosystems, and I was hearing on the streets of the campus, basically, that beef production in particular, I remember that was where it started, was very damaging to the environment. And I remember in particular hearing about how it was the leading cause of deforestation in the Amazon. And then I just began to hear that it was very resource intensive, it was very environmentally damaging, et cetera. And I just felt it was the right thing to do if I was an environmentally concerned citizen. And then, of course, that was already the time period where there was a lot of concern about meat and especially animal fat as a health concern. And so it felt like, well, this is the right thing to do from an environmental perspective and from a health perspective. So I decided to shift my diet. And I'm one of those people. I don't know, you may be the same way, Joy. I was never that much of a meat lover, so it wasn't that difficult to give up for me. And I just kind of stuck with the diet once I made that shift.
Yeah. And right now I have no desire. It didn't taste all that great. And the only thing I missed was the Wisconsin bratwurst, which I don't know if you've had the pleasure.
Definitely. Well, for me, it's interesting. There's this whole phenomenon called the bacon vegetarian, and it's the vegetarian who gets drawn back into meat eating by bacon. So for me, I've always really enjoyed the smell of, you know, processed meats like bacon and salami, which, ironically, those are probably the only kinds of meat that I now believe are a real health concern.
Yeah. Well, and there's so much to talk about here, but let's fast forward a little bit. So how does how did this environmentally conscious vegetarian end up as a cattle rancher?
Yes. Well, I have to give a little more biographical detail for it all to make sense. So I was a vegetarian for many years. I became a lawyer, went to law school at University of Michigan, and became a lawyer and practiced law for a number of years. And then I heard a speech given by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's an environmental lawyer and a very, active environmentalist. And it led me to decide to devote my career to environmental law, and I started working for the National Wildlife Federation. A while later, I had the opportunity to work directly for him in New York, and I took that job. And when I arrived in New York, shortly after I arrived, within a few days after I arrived there, he told me that his greatest concern around the country environmentally was the environmental impact of concentrated livestock operations, that the more industrialized model of livestock production. And it was something I didn't know very much about at the time. And I actually was a little hesitant to take the job, make that my full-time job at first, because that meant working full-time on manure, which didn't sound very glamorous to me. But I started learning about the issue and visiting communities that were really affected by big concentrated livestock operations. And I realized it was something that I was very interested in working on, because it really affected not just the environment, but people's lives and animals' lives. And I felt this was really an important issue that needed to be addressed. So I worked for 2 years for Bobby Kennedy Jr. specifically on the issue of livestock production. But during that time, I was also visiting farms and ranches around the country that were doing things very well. And it was through that I met a network of farmers that are all part of a group called the Nyman Ranch Organization. And the founder of that group is a man named Bill Nyman. Fast forwarding a little further, after I left that job, I ended up marrying Bill Nyman, moving from New York City to California, where the ranch that he lived on, and became a resident here, but didn't consider myself a rancher. And after being here for a few months, I became very interested in what was happening here and increasingly persuaded that what was happening on this ranch was very good land stewardship and very good animal husbandry. And the animals had very good lives and the land was very well taken care of. So I wanted to learn what was happening here and how to do it. Yeah. And so I sort of became, you know, one step at a time, and not intentionally, I became a rancher at that point.
Yeah. So love didn't make you toss your principles out the window. You're living your principles because you believe the way you're raising meat is good for us and good for the environment.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, at that point in time, I was never a person who accepted the idea that there's morally anything problematic about humans eating other animals. That, because my whole background, you know, as a child, I spent a lot of time outdoors, and I, you know, majored in biology in college, as I mentioned, and I've always looked at humans as, you know, part of the natural world. And there's so much, you know, animals eating other animals in the natural world that, to me, humans doing that makes a lot of sense, and there's nothing wrong with that. That being said, I think it's obviously perfectly okay for an individual to choose not to eat animal products, but I never felt that was, you know, a moral mandate for humans. So what I was increasingly becoming aware of during my years at Waterkeeper working for Bobby Kennedy was that meat production and the raising of animals, whether it's for dairy products or eggs or meat, has dramatically different environmental impacts depending on how it is done. So it can be done badly and it's extremely environmentally damaging, or it can be done well and it can be environmentally beneficial. So that is the whole case that my book makes, is that basically if you do it badly, cattle, you know, production is bad for the environment. If you do it well, it's not only, you know, my argument is it's not only benign, it's actually necessary for the optimal functioning of ecosystems.
Well, we have just a minute before a news break. Give us just a tease. How are you doing it well?
Well, what's really important is keeping the animals on grass as much as possible. In our ranch, we have them on grass all the time. But that's not possible in every geography. But like in Wisconsin, that's a much more challenging thing to do. But in Northern California, it's possible to have the cattle on grass all the time and to have the cattle very well managed so that that vegetative cover is always very healthy, which leads to healthy soils and very good water retention in the soils. So you actually have the opportunity with cattle to do sort of the best possible thing as far as food production in terms of the environment, because you're not having to disturb the ground, you're not having to disturb the vegetation, scrape the earth of the plants that are naturally there, and disturb the below ground environments, which are really important. So that's what we do, is we have our cattle continually on grass, and we move the cattle a lot. We keep them quite densely congregated, and we move them very frequently to keep the soils and the plants healthy.
Our guest is Nicolette Hahn Nyman, author of Defending Beef. And we will welcome your questions for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with a longtime vegetarian and author of Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for Nicolette Hahn Nyman. Not only is she a vegetarian, a longtime vegetarian, for environmental reasons, she's an environmental lawyer, and now she is a cattle rancher in California, telling us how well-raised beef is good for the environment and good for us and sustainable. And we welcome your questions or maybe even your challenges. Do you eat meat? Do you think that meat production and consumption is bad for us and bad for the environment? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, we have BJ on Facebook who says, primates do not need to eat flesh for health. There is so much that is wrong with the current meat industry. The giant feedlots are environmentally harmful. All the grain fed to the naturally grazing animals is harmful to them. Then there are the livestock owners calling for the elimination of our natural predators. These are just a few of the things I can think of off the top of my head. Well, Nicolette, you don't like the giant feedlots either.
No, I mean, I've spent the last 12 years of my life working against that sort of big industrialized animal production. I'm probably in agreement with much of what that person is saying. I worked full time as an environmental lawyer on these issues, as I mentioned, and I've done writing and speaking around the country on these issues for the last decade. And that's exactly my point. It's a completely different entity that we're talking about. When things are done well, especially when my book really focuses on cattle, so to talk about beef specifically, when things are done well, it's not just a question of not being damaging for the environment. It's actually a question of being environmentally essential. Now, the reason for that is because we need animals in these grassland areas, and without the animal impacts that were historically provided by wild animals, and those animals are no longer there, we will lose the opportunity to have properly functioning grassland ecosystems. So we really need to think in a long-term perspective about what the globe is supposed to look like. The globe was actually covered by grazing animals in prehistoric times, and grasslands have existed since shortly after the disappearance of the dinosaurs. They've been around forever. Humans have been, humans pretty much wiped out almost all of the wild animals of the globe in fairly recent geological history. And because of the fact that humans have done that, we've actually needed to, humans around the globe actually used fire to maintain grasslands. They were burned. Now, burning is not, there are many environmental problems with burning. And there are many reasons why using grazing animals that are controlled by humans, in other words, domesticated grazing animals, as a surrogate for those disappeared wild animals is a much better environmental alternative. So, I don't argue that all meat production is good. In fact, I've spent my last 12 years of my life arguing against a lot of types of meat production. But that doesn't mean that all meat production is bad. That's exactly the point of the book.
Right. But isn't, I don't know, getting into percentages here, isn't it? Isn't most meat production bad? And most of the time, we're going to be getting, factory farmed beef if we're eating beef.
Well, okay, first of all, when you look at the globe, most cattle and most grazing animals are actually raised on grass. The U.S. is sort of atypical in that we do a lot of grain feeding in the U.S. and we use feedlots a lot. That's actually not possible in most parts of the world, and it isn't done in most parts of the world. In the U.S., the majority of beef eventually goes into a feedlot. But what's really important to note, the argument of my book is that whenever you have cattle on grass, you have potential environmental benefits, whether those are dairy cattle or whether those are beef cattle. And all beef cattle are on grass for much of their lives. The mother cows are always on grass. In almost every geography, this is true. The bulls are on grass. The calves are on grass. It's really only in that latter portion of the lives of the animals that are being raised for meat, which is not the breeding animals, but those the offspring of the breeding animals, then they go into a feedlot. So you're talking about a portion of the animals that are out there and the impact that they're having on the environment. And that being said, I think it's also important to note, I think there is a time and a place for some grain feeding in the food system. But what's happened in the U.S. is it's been taken to an extreme. So we're using grain when we should be using grass. So, there's nothing inherently wrong with a little bit of grain feeding to cattle. It's not something that we do personally ourselves in the beef that we raise. But there is a place for it, both ecologically and in terms of good animal husbandry. But the point is, the best thing to do is have the cattle on grass as much as possible. And virtually all of the cattle that are in the food system are on grass for much of their lives. So I'm arguing in favor of that.
Let's take some calls. Key Rock in Milwaukee is with us first. Hi, Key
yes,
Rock.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning to your guests. As a First Nation person, original American, Alaskan Inuit, we oppose beef production. It never played a role in our diet. We've lived on this continent for arguably 30,000 years, and we find that there's no reason to eat any kind of meat like beef. Our diet consists solely of aquatic mammals and other proteins, and they are much more sustainable and our health is much greater. We eat no starches or carbohydrates, but we live long and fruitful lives. And obviously, beef has not helped European Americans in any way. They should look to our diet, and I can take any response off the air.
All right. Thank you, Key Rock. Nicolette?
Well, first of all, it's important to note, obviously, I've been a vegetarian for over 20 years. I don't argue people need to eat beef. My argument is that for people who do choose to eat it, it can be a good choice. I also would note that red meat, Native Americans have eaten historically, most groups of Native Americans have included lots of types of red meat in their diet. So I sort of disagree with the suggestion that traditional Americans did not eat red meat. There are, whether you're talking about deer or whether you're talking about bison, there was a great deal of red meat in the Native American diet. But more importantly, I'm not arguing that you have to eat red meat to be healthful. I'm simply arguing that it is a healthful food.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit more about that. A lot of people say, no, it's not. We eat it, clogs the arteries and gives us heart attacks.
Well, my book is divided into two parts. The first part looks at the ecological issues, and the second part is mostly devoted to looking at the human health issues. And what it does is it traces back sort of the sort of more recent history of the human diet. And I show that actually over the last few decades, red meat consumption, beef consumption has declined. Beef consumption has gone down by 22% in the last few decades. Red meat consumption today in the United States is about the same as it was in 1900. So there's a perception that we're eating more and more red meat, that we're eating more and more animal fat. We're actually eating about 20% less animal fat today than we were 100 years ago. So it is not logical to argue that modern chronic health problems are due to beef and due to animal fat. I go through a lot of research in the book, mm-hmm. and I show how on sort of all of the major health issues that have been attributed to red meat and animal fat, that actually the studies are very divided. And really, there's more and more evidence today that the major chronic diseases that are plaguing the United States and the westernized countries are more connected to sugar consumption and to processed foods. So meat, especially when it's unprocessed, fresh red meat and other meats that are not processed, have not been connected to major chronic health diseases. It's the two big studies. One was done by Harvard University. The other was a big European study that really made the attempt to differentiate between processed meats and fresh meats. Found that there was a connection with several types of health issues for processed meats, but that there was no connection at all for fresh, unprocessed red meat. So my point is, again, I don't argue you have to eat red meat to be healthy. I argue that for people who choose to eat it, it's a good choice.
I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Nicolette Hahn Nyman, who is the author of Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. Nicolette is an environmental lawyer, a vegetarian, and a cattle rancher in California. Our next caller is Susan in Janesville. Hello, Susan.
Oh, good morning, Joy. Good morning, Nicolette. When I first heard the topic of the show, I was not surprised. I'm a vegetarian. I live with a household of meat eaters, and for 5 years I've been trying to get us to raise our own meat.
Really?
Which people think is odd. Yeah, well, I don't have any problem with eating meat. I prepare it all the time. I think that meat is a fine alternative for some people. And I was thinking if we are having a household of meat eaters, it would make sense. We live out in the country. We should raise sustainable, healthy meat ourselves. I cannot get them on board. So I guess my comment is twofold. Do you have any advice for getting them on board? And two, you mentioned that one of the reasons you initially stopped eating meat was due to environmental concerns. Now that you are raising your own beef, why you have not gone back to meat?
Well, I do not believe those. The main reasons I chose to stop eating meat many years ago are things I no longer believe. But sort of at the beginning of the conversation, we talked about how, you know, you sort of get used to eating a certain way and it becomes the habit that you have. And I have just not found a desire to eat meat. And so personally, I haven't begun eating meat again. But I've always said, you know, in recent years that it's entirely possible that I would eat meat again because I don't see any reason not to do so. And if I felt the desire again, I would eat it. As far as raising one's own animals for food, I think it's a great idea. It's of course something that, you know, it's a different thing than raising your own vegetables or something, right? Because you're going to get to know those animals and then you have to take their lives for food. And there is there's a difficulty in that. There's no doubt about it. So I think that's a healthful exercise for people to go through if they're going to eat meat, because I do think there's a gravity to taking the life of an animal for food. And when people are directly connected with those animals, it really brings that message home. So I certainly think it's something that's worth trying as long as everyone, you know, goes into it with their eyes open and understands the difficulty that they may face as they get to the point where they're planning on taking the animal's life.
Well, in fact, there's a story in the news in Wisconsin, and they come up every once in a while of, I believe these were dairy cattle or dairy cows that were at the slaughterhouse, I think, and they ended up just getting beaten, and there's video of what looks to be abuse going on, and I think it is. Do you address that issue at all?
Well, I don't address the question of abused animals in my book, but it's certainly something that I've spent much of my life speaking out against and working against. You know, good farmers do not mistreat their animals. It's just that simple. And we actually, with our own animals, we raise both turkeys, heritage turkeys on grass, and we raise grass-fed cattle, as I mentioned. We ourselves are present at the slaughter of every animal because we don't want there to even be the possibility of any abuse of the animal. And also, we believe it's important to provide, to make sure that that animal is not afraid or, not experiencing any fear or stress. And if the person who's raised the animals is present, then that helps a lot to ensure that the animal is not afraid. So I think that's actually something we encourage other farmers and ranchers to do as well.
Joe in Dodgeville is with us. Hello, Joe.
Well, and I appreciate the segment that you have on this morning, Kathleen, and your guest seems to be very knowledgeable. The only thing I'd take I'd like to ask her about, I should say, is the grass-fed versus conventional-fed cattle. I believe, and maybe she can explain it a little bit, is that the average animal stays on grass about 93 to 95% of its life. Currently even. And so that leaves about 7% of its lifespan in a confined or feed efficient facility. You know, and one of the things I think that's overlooked in beef production is the carbon footprint that we have and the benefit that conventional production has. There's nothing wrong with grass-fed. I'm not a proponent or against. I think that they all have a niche market. There's a market for all of that product. But
we're losing you, Joe. Are you still there? Darn it. I think he wanted to say that I wish that he could have finished his argument.
He was saying, I believe, that the more conventional method has a lighter carbon footprint, I believe. And that's an argument that has been made. It's interesting. I don't specifically address the question of the carbon footprint of grass-fed compared to grain-fed. I actually just look at the issue of the way cattle are being raised the world over today and in the United States specifically, and I talk about the carbon footprint. I have a whole chapter on the climate change issue. So there are conflicting studies on the question of whether or not grass-fed versus grain-fed is more or less carbon footprint intensive. But what is increasingly sort of agreed on by scientists is that there's a tremendous opportunity for carbon sequestration in the grasslands of the world. In fact, it's believed now that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has said that 90% of the potential to mitigate the carbon footprint of agriculture altogether is through carbon sequestration in the soils. And the optimal place to do that, a lot of research has been showing, is the grasslands. So that's part of the reason I think that having cattle on grass is optimal environmentally, because it creates the opportunity for the carbon sequestration, taking carbon from the air, from the atmosphere, and getting it to go through the plant, and which the plant through its roots then puts it into the soils. That happens the best on unplowed, grazed lands, and that's where you have cattle maintaining those grasslands. That's why the grazing animals are an essential part of carbon sequestration.
Ben in Wausau is with us. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Joy. Great subject. I have a point of information for your learned guest. It is very possible to raise grass-fed beef in Wisconsin. I raised it for years. They grazed on the pasture half the year, and I fed them grass hay for the other half of the year. I was very proud of my herd, and those who bought sides from me were delighted in the product. Unless your guest has some questions of me, I'll take your response off the air.
Well, Ben, thank you for calling. It sounds like you're outside. Are you still farming or you're not anymore?
I retired a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, certainly that doesn't shock you, does it, Nicolette, that they're a grass-fed cattle rancher called from Wisconsin?
No, that doesn't surprise me at all. I've been on a lot of farms and ranches in Wisconsin, and I'm originally from Michigan. I've spent much of my life in the upper Midwest. I know farms and ranches that are doing things similar to what your caller is talking about. I've been on several totally grass-based dairies in Wisconsin. There's actually a grazing dairy movement that is stronger in Wisconsin than anywhere else in the country. So I'm very familiar with what your guest is talking about. My point is that in the northern parts of the world and in the northern parts of the United States, it is sometimes the best ecological choice, actually, to use more concentrated feeds. I don't think we, you know, should be clinging to some purist ideal about no grain, because grain can be fed perfectly healthfully to cattle. And when it is done for limited periods of time, it doesn't pose a major environmental problem, and it's perfectly healthy for the animal. So that's all I'm saying. I agree, and I think it's wonderful that the caller engaged in that practice, and I know quite a few farmers in that part of the world that are doing the same thing.
Thank you for the call, Ben. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with the author of Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production, The Manifesto of an Environmental Lawyer and Vegetarian Turned Cattle Rancher, Nicolette Hahn Nyman. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with an author who is also an environmental lawyer, longtime vegetarian, and cattle rancher, talking about how cattle ranching or how raising beef can be sustainable and good for the environment and good for us, too. We wonder what you think. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones. David in Wisconsin Dells is with us next. Hello, David.
Hi, is that me, Dave?
I'm sorry, it's what?
My name is Dave. I just wanted to make a couple comments.
Okay.
Well, I think that I don't agree totally with your guest. I'm a vegetarian, but that's not why I called. I think most cattle that are grown around the world that are grass-fed, it's farmed grass. It is hay that is grown. The animals consume vast amounts of water. Vast amounts of water is used just for their feed, and especially in the Central Valley, where the groundwater is so far depleted now, they couldn't supply the vast machines like McDonald's and some of the fast food joints on grazed cattle. So most of the places they're grazed, it's they're fed to grass. It isn't like they're out there just happy cows out in the field. That was my main comment. Then the other comment was just hers, where she wanted to make sure that the animals weren't mistreated. You know, it seems to me euthanasia is about the worst mistreatment an animal could have. But those are my comments.
All right. Thank you, David. I'm sorry, Dave. I misread that. How about his point that there's tons of water that is needed for this beef production for the grass?
Yeah,
Nicolette?
That's a really important question. I have a whole chapter in my book about water consumption. And, of course, when I was working as an environmental lawyer, All of the years that I worked as an environmental lawyer, water was my specialty. So this is kind of an area of great interest to me. The caller suggested that the majority of cattle around the world are being fed grown crops. That's not quite correct. The figures are really different depending on what part of the world you're looking at. And actually, the majority of the world, the cattle are fed entirely on naturally occurring grass. So that's an important point. In the United States, as I mentioned before, most cattle are on grass. You know, some cattle are on grass for all of their lives, and then most cattle are on grass at the beginning of their lives and then end up in feedlots. I certainly agree that when you're talking about feeding grown crops to cattle, that is more water intensive than having them entirely on grass. That's one of the reasons that I advocate for having cattle on grass for their entire lives. But it's important to note that even when you do that, even when you feed grown crops, to cattle in feedlots, it is far less water intensive than people generally believe. I mean, this is an issue that you'll see, you know, on websites and people blog about it and things like that. But when you actually look at the facts, it's quite different. The University of California at Davis, which is probably one of the world's leading agricultural colleges, did a very thorough analysis of what a typical pound of beef takes to produce as far as water consumption. They looked at every stage of the animal's life from birth to slaughter. And what they found in that study was that a pound of beef takes just slightly more water than a pound of rice to produce. Now, rice is a somewhat water-intensive crop as well, so I'm not saying beef is not water-intensive, but there are lots of water-intensive foods. They include coffee, chocolate, sugar, avocados, almonds, walnuts, and rice, as I mentioned. So beef is not kind of an outlier in the food system. It is one of the crops that is one of the foodstuffs that we produce as a society that is more water intensive than some others. But I argue in the book that it's very nutrient dense, and that the ecological benefits of having those animals on the grasslands outweighs the fact that it's relatively water intensive. So it's not nearly as water intensive as people tend to believe.
Here's a comment from Michael on Facebook. The latest issue of National Geographic has an article on population growth and meat consumption. And in this article, it states the inconvenient truth that cattle fed on grass-based diets emit more than twice as much methane as cattle fed grain. It also states that if we were to close all feedlots and feed all cattle by pasture, we would need a lot more land, a much larger cattle herd to get the same quantity of meat, and much higher emissions per animal. So, lots there. But what? So grass-fed cattle emit more methane.
Okay. I'm very familiar with the article, of course. I've not only read it, I've had extensive conversations with other people in the agricultural community about the article. It's important to note that the person who wrote it is a generalist, really doesn't know anything about agriculture or food production, and especially not about the issues that my book goes into in a lot of detail about methane and carbon footprint of agriculture and especially cattle production. So I don't want to – there's actually quite a bit in that article that I agree with, but I think he just missed the mark on this point. The reason why it's false is because what I talked about before, when you have the cattle on grass, you have the opportunity, when they're well managed, there's substantial carbon sequestration that takes place. When you have them in a feedlot, you have to feed them grains that are produced through plowing and planting and, in many cases, irrigation, et cetera. And that's where the intensive carbon footprint comes for beef production. So there's all of the analyses that have been done that were used in that article completely omitted any consideration of the carbon sequestration impact, which is enormous. It's, you know, I mentioned before, it's believed that 90% of the opportunity to mitigate greenhouse gases from agriculture is in soil carbon sequestration. It's a huge figure. There are some estimates that even say that we could more than offset all of agriculture's greenhouse gases through carbon sequestration. So that's why I really don't agree with the email that you got on that issue.
Next, let's go to Heather in Milwaukee. Hello, Heather.
My question was, when you're making the statement that grass-fed beef is not necessarily, you know, that harmful when you add grains to it for the environment or for the animal, and I can see your point in that, but I've been to workshops where they were discussing beef production and grass-fed beef, and the nutritional aspect of the beef was considered superior to those that are grain-finished because of the fat ratios, and I mean that the beef would also be less acidifying to the person's pH who's consuming it. So, I mean, overall, do you think it's still better to eat 100% grass-fed beef than it is to eat it when it's grain-finished for the person who may be wanting to include that in their diet?
Yes. I mean, what I say, and I talk about the nutritional issues in a lot of detail in the book. I compare very specifically the nutritional content of totally grass-fed beef to more conventionally raised beef. The nutritional component is definitely superior. It is consistently superior in terms of the omega-3 content as far as several, and the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6 fats. It's better in terms of several vitamins. But the reality is that each of those differences is quite small. And so what I say in the book and what I really believe is that there is a nutritional benefit to eating totally grass-fed beef, but it is not enormous. What is important is that almost always in the United States, when grass-fed beef is produced, it is done without hormones. It is done without the feeding of other additives, other chemicals, other drugs, which unfortunately are routinely used in the mainstream beef industry. And in fact, my book is very specific about criticizing those practices. So when you buy totally grass-fed beef, and actually the benefits, by the way, the health benefits of totally grass-based dairy products are even more well documented. So I definitely think it's a good thing for people to seek those things out. But what's really important, I think, is that you can be quite confident that those objectionable practices that are occurring in much of the mainstream meat industry are not taking place when you buy the totally grass-fed product. So that's actually, in my view, that's a better reason to seek it out.
Mm-hmm. So grass-fed beef is going to cost me a lot more than conventionally fed beef?
Yes. I mean, in general, it's, you know, these are all sort of averages. And, you know, I believe that it's worth it to pay more, maybe eat less of it. You know, that's the, you know, the idea I put forth in my first book, Righteous Pork Chop, is that in order to make things affordable, you know, most people in the Western world eat significantly more meat and dairy than is really nutritionally necessary or advantageous even. So I think people should eat less meat and eat better meat, and that would include beef. I think if you really look at the issue, it is worth it to cut back your consumption a little bit. If you don't have enough money to buy the same amount and you want to make a transition to grass fed, you can do that by reducing your portion sizes. You can also, if you're cooking, you know, when you cook, you give yourself a lot of power because you can buy lots of cuts of beef from your local farmer's market or, you know, from through your whatever source you have to get to local beef. You can find cuts of beef that you have to cook a little bit more, you know, cook long, slow cooking methods, for example. And you can get cuts of beef that are quite inexpensive, that is totally grass-fed. So that's another way to do it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have a friend who will insist on, if she has meat when we go out to a restaurant, that it is grass-fed. She looks for restaurants that serve it. She asks if it's not labeled. Most of the time it is, I think. I mean, how How popular is the grass-fed beef? And are more and more restaurants carrying it?
Well, I think that's great that your friend is doing that, because she's actually part of the solution. Asking for it is really important. Asking your grocery store, asking your restaurant to carry it. It's about 5% of the total beef that's produced in the United States right now. That's a very small number. But the number is growing quite a bit because of the consumer interest. So I think that the more that people, you know, seek it out and request it, we're going to see more and more of it. It is a growing segment of the beef industry.
Let's go next to Matt in Menominee Falls. Hi, Matt.
Hi. My question is, I might be a little off topic, but the gist of my question is how government subsidies play a role in farming, you know, maybe either farmers getting in or out of the business, or just, you know, just in general, the farm subsidies in your situation in farming.
Yeah, and does it apply to our discussion, Nicolette?
There's really no direct subsidy. This is actually kind of an interesting question, because there's a perception. I see this often in sort of advocacy materials against meat, that this is a hugely subsidized industry. That's really not true. There is no direct subsidy of the beef industry or of the meat industry in general. There are several forms of indirect subsidies. People who are the segment of the industry that is feeding grain is at some time benefiting from a grain subsidy that existed for quite a while. It's not really applicable anymore, because it's a sort of a it's something that guarantees a certain price for grain if it drops below a certain point, and that hasn't happened in a while. So it's not really relevant recently. And for totally grass, going back to that question, going to talking about totally grass-fed cattle, those are really not subsidized. So it's not that big of a factor in the beef industry.
Here's not a lot of time, but Diane emails, what do you say to people who say that sustainable meat production can't be done on a large enough scale to feed the world, and that industrial meat production is necessary to meet that demand?
Well, in my book, Defending Beef, I address that issue very directly, because it's a really important question that I get a lot. The issue has been looked at very specifically by a number of large studies, and it really is a false assumption. It absolutely can be done, and it's really a matter of, for one thing, we need to redirect government policies rather than subsidizing foods like sugar and grain. You know, why are we not subsidizing more transitions to organic and grass-based agriculture? But there is enough land. The Savory Institute, which is an institute based in Colorado that works internationally to promote sustainable grazing practices, has actually found that if you were to use the optimal management approach for cattle in the United States, where the cattle are actually more densely herded and moved frequently to mimic wild herds, that there's actually a surplus of land in the United States to do that. If you got rid of all of the grain production that's, you know, raised for cattle and all of the feedlots, you could put them all on grass and you'd still have plenty of space left over. So it's an assumption people make, but it's not true.
We're done. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Nicolette Hahn Nyman is author of Defending Beef. Thanks to Brianne Chasso and to Christy Taylor for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.